Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everyone. This is Jim McGrew, Chief Client Services Officer at Ogletree Deacons. Thanks for joining us for another podcast. In this episode, Bern Decker, a shareholder in our Portland, Maine office, and Steve Silver, an associate in the Portland office, will talk all things ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. From when ERISA applies to best practices for navigating common challenges. Steve, I'll turn it over to you to get started.
All right. Hello, everyone. Thanks, Jim, and thanks for joining us for the Ogletree Deacons podcast. My name is Steve Silver, and I'm an associate in Ogletree's newest office in Portland, Maine. And today I'm joined by the managing shareholder here, Bern Decker.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bern. So we talk about ERISA, and we should probably step back because some people listening might not know what that is, or you know what the acronym is, or think it's some sort of disease or something like that. What is ERISA? Kind of 101.
Well, I mean, as simply stated as possible, ERISA is the federal law that governs the employee benefit relationship between an employer and its employees. So anytime you have a benefit of employment, ERISA is going to govern that situation and govern that relationship. The statute was enacted to try to help protect pension benefits, back in the 1970s. But it also governs welfare benefits like life insurance and disability insurance and severance packages and things of that nature as well.
Okay, so we're talking about private employers with group policies that would be litigated in federal court, right?
Sure. So again, if an employer decides to offer its employees disability insurance, the most common way for it to do that is to purchase a group policy from an insurance company and to offer that coverage to its employees as a benefit of employment. And there are various different levels of coverage that they can choose. They can essentially design the plan as they see fit. Sometimes they'll pay for all the premiums. Sometimes employees have to pay for some of the premiums. But, you know, if a claim is made under a group disability policy that is governed by ERISA, the person can sue in federal court if his or her claim is denied, and ERISA will govern the way that that case moves through the system.
Now, we talk about employers and employees, and there's certainly lots of cases defining what those are in this area. I think many employers think about cutoffs, 50 employees or more, or 100 or more for different areas of the law. But for ERISA, what matters? I mean, how many employees does it take to determine if you've got an ERISA plan?
Well, there are a number of different factors that go into whether you have an ERISA plan. In terms of how many employees you need, you just need one. I mean, you need one employee beyond sole working shareholder of a company. So, I mean, plans come in all different shapes and sizes, but it's not a situation where just because you only have 15 employees or even 3 employees, ERISA is not going to govern it. It is, as long as you have one employee in addition to a sole working shareholder.
So this is something that a business owner or HR administrators needs to know, small businesses and large national corporations.
That's right. I mean, ERISA governs the gamut, and it doesn't even necessarily, again, on the welfare side, it doesn't necessarily have to be an employer purchasing a group policy. It can be an employer that goes out and purchases a bunch of individual policies for its main employees and such. So it just has to be a plan to provide benefits for certain things like sickness, accident, disability, things of that nature.
Okay. And now we talk about plan administration versus claim administration and who's the administrator. Often it is the employer who's actually the plan administrator. And what are some, I guess, responsibilities that they may have, which also leads to another question of some common mistakes that they should be on the lookout for or things to avoid?
Right. So, you know, typically the employer is the administrator of its own plan. And employers are, you know, certainly used to administering their pension plans or hiring third parties to do that. There's some common misconceptions in terms of an employer perhaps believing that on the welfare side, which is, again, health and life and disability, if it buys a group policy, all the administration is in the hands of the insurance company. That's just not the case. Everything that has to do with getting employees enrolled in the plan and determining their eligibility and keeping track of their status in terms of whether they're still covered under the particular plan or policy, and doing the things that are necessary when someone's coverage terminates or ends, such as providing, you know, conversion notices that would allow an employee whose group coverage is going to terminate to convert to an individual policy. Those are all plan administrator duties that the insurance company really has no way to do. The insurance company doesn't know what's going on with the comings and goings of employees. So those are employer responsibilities. Some do them themselves. Some farm them out to third-party administrators. But anytime you've got a situation where you've got that employer-insurer relationship and you've got, you know, forms going out, enrollment forms, you got to decide, oh, is this coverage that needs evidence of insurability? And so the employer might have to, you know, give the employee a form that they have to fill out before they can become covered. Mistakes happen in that regard. It's usually on the front end. The most common scenario is the particular coverage in question requires the employee to show they're insurable. There's a lot of coverages that don't need that, but when they do, the employer has to know you got to give this employee a form, and they're not going to get that coverage unless they provide the evidence of insurability. So we see situations where that doesn't happen.
And where that happens kind of on the back end, right? A lot of times somebody may have died, life insurance claim or accidental death claim, you know, and the beneficiary goes to collect and learns that there was no coverage. Right.
No, I mean, that's right. I mean, so the employer has to be aware of the comings and goings of its employees as it relates to whether they continue to be covered under a particular plan. And again, the most common scenario of a mistake that occurs is, you know, most group policies have conversion rights. So if your group coverage ends, you can convert to an individual policy without having to show you're insurable, which is a great benefit, although it's very expensive. But you only have a short amount of time to do that. And so if the employer doesn't give the person notice, they might miss the window. And we see litigation over issues like that sort of all the time.
Okay. So when I was thinking about doing this podcast, it really came to me when I was just watching football and thinking about sports. We're getting into bowl season. And I read some articles about, you know, top college athletes, and I'm sure pro athletes do too, but that purchase individual disability policies, you know, protect themselves going in the draft and things like that. In these individual cases, which would often be sort of a breach of contract type of claim, how does your defense strategy differ versus maybe a group plan, ERISA governed in federal court?
Well, I mean, I don't want to preclude the notion that an individual policy can't be governed by ERISA. Because it can. But assuming that it's not, it's a whole different ball of wax when you've got a straight breach of contract claim that's going to be governed by state law. That is unlike an ERISA case, which is a fairly streamlined administrative record review. A claim under an individual policy is just like any other breach of contract claim, subject to state contract and insurance laws, which in many, many states provide for broad remedies, extra contractual damages, punitive damages, bad faith damages, things of that nature, that none of those are available under ERISA. There's broad, if not unlimited, discovery in those situations, unlike ERISA, where discovery is very limited. And so, I mean, that's one of the beauties of having a practice like this, is because it allows you to have your foot in both doors. So you've got to bring your real litigation skills to bear when you're litigating these non-ERISA individual policies, you know, lots more depositions and trials, as a matter of fact. So the exposure is usually a lot larger, the scope of the litigation is much broader, and the potential downsides are also much greater.
Okay, now something we do here a lot is as soon as the complaint comes in, analyzing that, looking at, is this an ERISA claim or not? In a recent sports case, which again caught my attention because that's what I'm looking at when I'm not doing ERISA work. And what struck me is his complaint, and again, he was asserting disability due to a hip injury. And this was a group policy from the league. His complaint was filed in state court, asserting breach of contract, bad faith, and some other state law claims. And this is not unusual. Even though that's an ERISA claim, we get these all the time from plaintiffs. So what do you look for? Once you've got a complaint in the door and you determine that ERISA does govern, what are the steps you take to get that to federal court?
Well, if we're at the place where we've decided ERISA governs, and sometimes it is hard to make that determination because, again, if we're representing an insurance company and we're trying to determine whether the employer's plan is governed by ERISA, we might not have all that information. So we need to know, is it exempt from ERISA based on being a governmental plan or a tribal plan or a church plan? Or is it potentially exempt from ERISA under what they call the safe harbor, which means the employer essentially does nothing but just simply allows the insurance company to come in and advertise its own policy to its employees. If we've surmounted those hurdles, then what we need to do is remove the case to federal court, which is a fairly simple process. It's a notice, a document that is usually pretty straightforward and just explains to the court that, hey, listen, this plaintiff filed this case under state law in state court, but it's actually governed by ERISA. And the scope of ERISA is so broad that it essentially preempts the field with respect to any claim that's brought under an ERISA plan. So that is what gives the federal court jurisdiction to hear it. And that is what essentially takes out of the ballgame all that stuff that the plaintiff has pled with respect to contract damages, extra contractual damages, punitives, all those things.
Okay. And you mentioned preemption, which we could do a whole podcast on. So we're not going to go down that road. But while I have you here, as someone who's litigated, hundreds, maybe thousands at this point, disability cases, a hot topic is seeing disabilities for neurocognitive claims based on concussions. I mean, this is happening at all levels of sports, both individual and group. Does it change at all when you're trying to assess what an insurer's determination was from a physical disability versus something that is cognitive related, neurocognitive?
Well, I mean, it certainly is different than certain types of physical disabilities that are objectively verifiable. A lot of these neurocognitive complaints are at least arguably not objectively verifiable or very difficult to objectively verify. There are certain physical claims that are like that as well, just fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome. Some of those disorders are very subjective in nature. You can assess a neurocognitive complaint, based on something called neuropsychiatric testing, which is a battery of tests that purport to show whether or not someone's cognitive functioning has declined from their original baseline. But it is far, far from an exact science. The practitioner is supposed to include validity measures to assess things like secondary gain. I mean, anytime there's secondary gain possibilities, you have to assess for that. And a lot of times in these cases, what we see are dueling neuropsychiatric reports where two psychologists or practitioners review the same data and come with vastly discrepant opinions. So they're difficult claims in that respect, and claims administrators have to spend a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of those particular types of cases.
All right. All right. Well, thank you, Bern. I know you're a busy guy. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks, Steve. It was great to be with you today.
Thank you, Bern and Steve. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast and that you'll join us for our next episode. In the meantime, this is Jim McGrew wishing you much success in your workplace. So long.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.